You're listening to Buildopedia, your go-to podcast for everything you need to know about property. By covering the entire journey from buying your home through to design, building, selling, and everything in between, we'll help you fill in the blanks and bring your property vision to life.
Welcome to Buildopedia. Today we have Justin Getty, who is someone who inspired me, I think, to have a podcast because I listened to Justin's podcast a couple of years ago and I went, yeah, this is a good idea. And at the time, Justin was one of the only people who had a property development podcast that I could find and I was intrigued. So Justin, welcome and thank you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Matt. What a fantastic introduction. I think that's the best introduction I've had so far going on any podcast. So thank you very much for those kind words. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. And I haven't even started yet. So Justin's a professional property developer. So again, totally someone I took inspiration from because you started your own development business. You're an educator and a podcast and you're creating content. You've got a, I'll let you tell us what you've got, but you do have something of a training system for developers.
Yes, I do have an online training program for people who are interested in getting into property development. I've also written a book about my own experience and journey into property development called Become a Million Dollar Property Developer. And that's off the back of some scars and hard-won experience on some projects that haven't quite gone to plan. And obviously speaking to lots of guests on my podcast as well. So I wrap that all up in an online training program to help people get into property development if that's what they're interested in.
Yeah. So tell us the name of the training program you have, by the way.
Yeah. So it's called Property Developer Training. Does what it says on the tin. And you can find that at propertydevelopertraining.com. And if people are interested in listening to the podcast, it's the Property Developer Podcast again. Does what it says on the tin, which you can find at propertydeveloperpodcast.com. But I'm sure people would much prefer to hear about my experience and your experience and what they can do if they're interested in getting into property development or if they're thinking about doing projects.
Yeah, so I'm kind of more in a smaller scale. I don't do development in the way you do it. For me, it's one house at a time, one small project at a time, and I don't have your wealth of experience, but I think I can relate to a lot of the topics on your podcast, a lot of the people. There's a lot of great learning. And the idea for our discussion today was, well, what are the things that professional property developers know? What are those underlying principles that do translate to a lot of our listeners who are, I guess, aspiring developers or looking to buy their first home or renovate their first home? So we're kind of, I guess you're more at the professional end of things. We're more at the general purpose information source, but we're trying to delve into what are those tricks of the trade? What are the things that people don't tell you is what I want to know. That's the interesting thing for us. So,
yeah. And I didn't start out meaning to be doing medium density property development projects that I'm doing now. My first project was meant to be a 6-unit site, which I thought was actually a pretty good sized project to do on my first property development, but it ended up morphing into a 20 townhouse project. So it got way bigger than I ever expected and I just took it from there. So since then I've done a number of multi-unit medium density projects. The first one went pretty well, even though it was way bigger than expected. And then my second one ended up going a lot different than I expected in that we got a refusal for a 19 townhouse proposal and had to go to court to try and get it overturned and ended up losing that hearing and had to go back to the start and with a fresh planning application. So things have kind of haven't gone exactly according to plan, which I think is probably reflective of what happens when you're doing a property development or a renovation project. I think very rarely does it go exactly according to plan and you need to adapt and evolve along the way to deal with the issues that pop up.
Yeah. And speaking of going to plan, like I never do any podcast to plan. Kim, our editor and marketing manager, lovingly prepares a script, and I always get lost and forget. But I do want to ask, because, and this is one thing I've learned from you, you on every podcast, you ask someone's favorite food, right, as an icebreaker. And so we want to ask who inspired you in the last week, in the last month, who or what book or what is that inspiration thing? So that's our Justin Getty version of what's your favorite meal. So do you have someone to share or something to share?
Yes. So I would say an inspiring moment for me in the last week was Australia winning the first Ashes cricket test in England after looking like they were behind in the whole game, and then they managed to win on the final day in a pretty pulsating game. So considering the history that of the team at Edgbaston and how we've lost a few close matches there in recent times and over the history, to see Australia get up over England on that final day was pretty inspiring, and I certainly enjoyed the win like a lot of Aussies did, I'm sure. Another book that I've read in the last week that might be of interest to some of your listeners is a book called The Power of Nice by Ronald Shapiro, which is a book on negotiating, so which is another key skill that anybody who's involved in property should be continually interested in.
Yeah, right. So the premise of that is that you can be nice, or is it that you should act nice as you knife someone in the back? What's the premise?
Well, the premise is that you shouldn't be trying to knife people in the back, and I think a good negotiation will result in both sides feeling happy with the outcome. And so there's a process you can follow to try and get an outcome, and things that you can do to give yourself the best advantage without taking advantage of the other side.
Well, the reason I got you, to be fair, is because I was like, I'd love to chat to Justin. He's got a podcast. I know he's good at talking. I'd love to chat to him. But the thing that I proposed as a talking point, as a subject, is development principles, underlying principles of development. Because I have got mine that I dusted off for this episode. I know you probably got some of your own principles. It takes such a long time to test the principle because property development is a very slow burn. And your personal, I mean, even in your case, your sample size, even though you've got a few on the trot, in terms of statistical analysis, the sample sizes are quite small, right? So I guess by the time you learn that assumptions you've made that may have worked for some things don't work for other things, it might be too late. So I thought, why don't we test those principles? I'm also curious as to how my principles or how a professional developer's set of development principles can help people generally in procuring property, buying, designing, developing, and how those skills are translatable, because my sense is that most of the underlying principles are translatable, whether you're developing, whether it's a small property that you're doing, assuming you're doing it for profit and not as a personal indulgence, which is, that's fine, that's a separate thing. But the underlying principles of creating value and making a profit on property development, my thinking is whether you're Lendlease doing a massive development or a single homeowner or a couple buying their first house for $1 million in Sydney or Melbourne, I think the underlying principles are the same. So that's my question. That's the question I want to ask today.
Well, I think you've touched on it there in terms of one of the first things you need to figure out is what's your purpose? Why are you doing the project, or why are you buying the property? Is it to make a profit? And a certain amount of profit? Is it to deliver a design outcome? You want to get a property in a design book? Or are you building something or doing something to live in for 5 years or 10 years? So your purpose is always the first starting point, in my opinion.
So let's presume because that opens up such a myriad of complication. Let's presume for today's episode that we're talking about financial return. And everyone's got, I think everyone who buys a property, even if you're buying to live in it, there's always a breakup of what percentage of that is for your personal use, what percentage is financial return. So there's always, we almost put a number on it when we're talking to new clients who are about to buy or have bought a house and they're looking to develop. We say, well, what's your split? And for some clients, they just don't care because they have enough money and they're more interested in making it something that suits them, even if they reduce the number of bedrooms and create a comfortable ensuite, master suite, and absorb a bedroom, technically reducing that house's number of bedrooms, maybe on paper, reducing the value. But in their mind, one of my clients said recently, the next buyer can worry about that, you know. So, yeah, some people are totally skewed towards, well, they don't want to overspend, but that 90% of it is, I just want to make it how I want to live in it, and that's it. Other people are like, well, really, we're going to live in it, but we want to make sure that we can sell it, and they're 90% focused on profit. So let's focus on the money today.
That's a good point there in terms of, well, how much money are you looking to make? Are you really looking to maximize the return, or are you willing to compromise and do a couple of things that you like, but you've got an eye on making X amount of dollars? Because that can sometimes lead to a different outcome in terms of how you design something, how you finish it off, the fittings and fixtures that you might use. So there's always going to be that question about what kind of return and how are you going to get there?
So let's maximize the return today. Let's ramp it up. Let's go all in and say, we want to maximize return. We want to build wealth. Like, let's focus on that end, because otherwise it unravels into a million options.
So I think the first thing that you need to do when you're talking about maximizing is understand who your end buyer is going to be. Who is the market? Who's the buyer? And really understanding them. Because if you're going to be delivering something and you want to maximize it, then you want to deliver a product that somebody in mind desires to buy. So that's your first point of call, because there's no point spending all this money and delivering some amazing product only to discover that actually there's no one that really wants to spend that amount of money, and they don't want Italian tiles in the bathroom, and they don't want a marble pool, indoor pool. All those kind of crazy things that you might go and put into the property, there's no demand for that.
Okay, so let's unpack that. How do you know what your buyer wants? How do you, Justin Getty as developer, how do you find out what your buyer is after?
So it comes down to market research. So you want to figure out where you're going to be doing this project. So I'm going to work off the assumption that you've got an area in mind that you're looking to do a project. And then you're looking at the market. So you're looking at properties that are for sale, the history of what has been sold, and you want to find out what the market depth is, how many of these properties are selling, and who are they selling to. And the way you can establish that is by becoming friends with every agent in the area and going and meeting with them and talking to them and milking them for all the intel that you can get about that type of product, the demand, the depth, what it needs to look like, the finishes. Agents are really useful for gathering that sort of intel.
I'll qualify that with useful agents are useful. So I found that and I'd be keen to hear your thoughts, but there is quite a difference from one agent to another. Some of them are incredibly knowledgeable, incredibly helpful. Some of them really aren't going to help you a hell of a lot. So so how do you know who? Because I guess the difference, I guess, for me is I work locally. That's my strategy. I know that you're probably more like, you've got developments in different parts of Melbourne. Correct me if I'm wrong, but you're not confined to a specific geographic area.
My first three projects were all in the same area. But my latest project is regionally based.
So how do you get to know, how do you cut through and go, who are the people that I need to speak to?
Yeah, conversations, just speaking with them. You'll be able to figure out pretty quickly who are the knowledgeable ones, who understand the market. A lot of agents only really understand their listings. They don't necessarily know the other listings in the area. They don't know what they sold for. So you need to talk to all of them, and then you'll probably start to find out that there's certain agents that specialize or focus on a particular type of property. So you want to try and find the ones most relevant to what you're looking to do. Because there's no point looking at if you're looking at doing a luxury development at $5 million, there's no point talking to the local agent who seems to sell a lot of units, 2-bedroom units, to first home buyers.
Yeah. So find someone who's selling the sort of product that or the type of property that you're going to develop. So if it's someone doing units, find someone who sells a lot of units so they know what they're talking about.
Yeah. And that principle applies to everybody that you're going to bring onto your team, because you're going to need a team to help you get the project done. And you want to find the right people who are good at what you're looking at doing to help you.
I'll just pick up on something you said before, because you did say do your research, see what's selling, see what agents want. But there's a different school of thought that I've had some success with, which is don't do what other people are doing. Do something that, and in my case, it's something that breaks through what an expectation is for that property. Again, I've got a very small data set, and COVID disrupted that data, like with ebbs and flows of COVID, where the ground shifted, my data set skewed terribly. And that's one of the things that I guess I picked up, and a mutual podcast guest that we've got is Andy Hoyne. And I first heard him on your podcast, Justin, and since then I've looked him up. He's very generous of his time. He's a great guest. I love chatting to him. So, and he, one of his theses is that it needs to be something that's not a, you don't want to be a follower. You don't want to be a spreadsheet jockey. You want to create something exceptional, maybe misrepresenting slightly, but that's kind of part of his approach. Yeah.
I had a guy on my podcast called Joe Adsett, who's a fantastic architect based in Brisbane, and he used the term pioneering. He likes to be a pioneer in terms of carving a path and doing something new and unique in a market, because he says, then I don't have any competition.
Absolutely. But how do you know when you've over, because you're going to be an outlier. So Andy's thesis is, you don't want to be a follower, because why would you put something to market that everyone else is putting to market? But on the flip side, you're doing your research. You see where I'm heading? Like if you do your research, you know what's selling in the market. The agents are going to tell you what's selling. Then that conflicts a little bit, because you're going to be, suddenly you're an outlier. And are you taking a risk, or are you, as Andy says, are you taking a risk by being a follower? So I don't know. What do you reckon?
I think it actually comes down to the person that's doing the project and their risk appetite and their risk profile. Because if you're somebody who's adverse to risk, you're not going to go and be a pioneer. And no matter what anyone tells you, it's just not going to be part of your DNA to go and push the envelope and deliver something crazy. Well, not even crazy, but just something that pushes the boundaries or that's unique. It's just not going to happen for someone who's risk averse. So I think it actually comes back to the person doing the project. What are they prepared to do? How far are they prepared to push the boundaries?
Yeah. And I guess from Andy's perspective, you're taking a risk if you're just doing what everyone else does. That's as risky as doing something outside. So where does the risk land? And I guess maybe my thinking would be, you still got to know what you're doing. You can't just blindly create a monster. maybe you do need to follow those underlying principles of good design.
I think it comes back to, we were talking about market depth. What's the market depth? Because if you've got a deep market, for example, a luxury property at multiple millions, for example, then maybe there are a couple of buyers that are prepared to spend a couple of extra hundred for something a bit unique. But if you're in a market that doesn't have a lot of depth for big sales, then perhaps it is quite risky, because you really are looking for the needle in the haystack buyer to come along and pay overs or a premium for what you're presenting.
How do you define depth? Like, give us a practical example of depth. Like, what's a market that has depth?
Well, it would be sales and transactions of the types of property that you're looking at. So that might be an area that has a lot of two-bedroom apartments. There's 50 or 70 or 100 types of that product transacting every year. That's quite, there's a lot of depth there in that particular area. But there may only be 5 transactions of 3-bedroom properties, because there just aren't that many in that area. And those properties sell for 4 million or 5 million, as an example. I would say that's not a huge level of depth for 3-bedroom properties in that market.
So the market I know is the inner west market of Sydney. And it's, I guess, I kind of know Melbourne because one of my best friends lives in Melbourne. And, you know, I know Melbourne from riding a bike through the burbs from one brewery to another normally on a weekend when I go to visit. But I guess, I'm trying to remember the inner burbs, but I guess that there's a translatable suburb in Melbourne that matches the inner west of Sydney, you know, like a few Ks out of town, but heritage conservation areas. And I know these spaces around Melbourne, I don't know immediately what's 2K, whether, I don't remember whether Richmond is 2Ks or 5Ks out of Melbourne off the top of my head, because Melbourne's a bit of a, it doesn't, when you're from Sydney, nothing's a grid. You go to Melbourne, everything's a grid, you're lost. Like, how do I find myself when Sydney's more like a mashed up hub and spoke, whereas Melbourne's this funny, neat place where you don't really know how you ended up from one place to another. So I guess what I'm getting at is, in the inner heritage conservation area suburbs of a city, my strategy would be not to be a follower, not to do what everyone's doing, to really create a product that exceeds expectations. So that's one of my core principles that I follow, to exceed the expectations of the buyer and create something that blows people away a little bit without going to town, without putting spas and saunas, without going to the nth degree. Like, I don't believe in overspending on finishes, but the design has got to be just right and it's got to exceed. And I guess in some cases it's not hard, because there's a lot of development that's a bit, ends up one way or another a little bit awkward, where you're in a space where you can't find your way out of. And so great floor plan and great spaces would be another underlying principle.
Absolutely. And it comes back to understanding that market. And so a good agent who sells a lot of product in the area that you're looking at and the type of product that you're talking about doing should be able to provide some of that insight in terms of, listen, if you make the bedrooms a little bit smaller but make the living area a little bit bigger, that's actually going to get a better outcome, because people are spending more time in the living room, kitchen living room, than they are in the bedroom. Or you don't need a bath in the main bathroom, because the people who are going to buy this are over 65, because they've got the money. They don't want a bath. They want a big shower. They should be able to give you insights into where people see value, and that's where you can invest your time and money. And also having a good designer should be able to give you some of that insight as well, about where can you invest time, money and effort to get the greatest return.
And one thing I focus on is actually planning how the property will be marketed, what it will look like. And I guess I always focus on thinking about how it tells a story. And I always think about brand from the outside. And a little bit different because they're all one-off properties. In kind of contrast to you, Justin, I invest in single residences. And because it's safer, because it's easier, because it's a market I know well. I don't subdivide. There's limited scope to subdivide or in the area that I know. So, but I always focus on what story will I tell to the buyer? What is the brand that I'm building here in this property? How am I going to engage with the buyer? Is that something that you can relate to? And is that similar if you're doing multi-residential, if you're doing 20 apartments? Is that still the same?
Yes, absolutely. And again, it comes back to your purpose. Are you intending on doing this over and over again and building a business brand or a development brand that's going to continue over 5 years, 10 years, 15 years? Or are you just doing individual projects that get branded and then once it's finished, it gets wrapped up and forgotten about? So if you're trying to build a business brand or a development brand, then you absolutely want to be thinking about your values and what you want to be known for and ensuring that you actually execute and deliver that.
And do you have something that you reference and share with your team as in a list of principles?
Yes, I'll always do a design brief at the start of a project, listing out who I think the buyers are, some of our brand values and what we're looking to achieve.
And do you have like just underlying principles that you keep somewhere that recur for every project? Let me just tell you one of my principles, and it's maybe because I'm lazy, but I have one of my underlying development principles is the dog walking rule, where I will only buy property where I walk my dog. And I go for long, like, you know, I walk my dog around, like I don't just go around the block, right? So I live in Balmain, lots of harbour around. I live in Rozelle, but live and work in Balmain area on the peninsula. And so I walk a bit. Like I don't just, the dog walking rule isn't just around the block or just to the local park, but it's places where I walk my dog I know intimately, and that's where I invest. Do you have a dog walking rule equivalent?
Well, given that my developments are about 30 Ks from where I live, I'm going to have to say no, because I don't think the dog or myself would make it that far on a walk. So no, I don't think it needs to be a dog walking rule. I think it comes back to, it'll be your budget that'll drive where you can look to buy primarily. So that's probably going to be your first.
I guess the dog walking rule is, you know, it's not literally that you have to walk your dog. It's that you have to know that space really well. Like you have to know the area before you invest in that area and before you develop, I guess, in that area.
Yeah, you absolutely want to understand the area that you're buying into or that you're planning on doing a project in before you jump in. And that goes back to our discussion earlier on with talking to agents, looking at the depth of the market, what properties are for sale. That's a really good way of getting an early understanding of the market.
And apart from talking to agents, how well do you have to know that area? Like that's because in our streets, in the streets that I know, I guess one street to another is a different world. 200 meters that way is a very different deal, is a very different property, is seen, you know, like, because I guess more so in the premium end of the market, like people who are buying a premium property usually don't want to be on a bus route, and that might be, but 50 meters the other way is a different world almost. So I guess how much time do you put into studying a place?
I would be initially doing some feasibilities on projects in a particular area to find out whether or not they actually were worth doing. And if the rough feasibilities work, then you would continue digging in to that location. And then that's where you would be able to start finding out where the premium spots are, where the less desirable streets are, or the less desirable pockets, and start zeroing in. And yes, you could drive around the area, walk around the area to get a bit of an idea of what's nice, what's noisy, where the nice properties are, where the little pocket parks might be, where the strip shops might be. And again, it doesn't take you too long to figure out where the nice parts of a particular area might be, whether that's a suburb or a couple of suburbs.
And yeah, what else have we missed? Like, what are the Justin Getty underlying principles? What haven't we hit yet?
I think you've always got to understand who the reason why you're doing a project, which we've already touched on, but I think that's a really important one, understanding your purpose, because that's going to drive everything that you do. And then the second part is building a team around you of people that are going to be able to help you realize your vision about what you want to do. Because development, firstly, is a financial game. And then second, it's a people game, because you can't do everything yourself. So you got to have people help you. So how can you manage relationships? And those two together will dictate how well your projects go, I think.
And how do you go about building a team? Because that's, again, that's something I can relate to. Without a team, like, so a team, one of the first thing, and it comes back to my view of selling, thinking of selling before you're even investing, is the relationship with the agent, the relationship with knowing who you're. So do you know who your sales agent is going to be before you even start the process? Or
no, because you'd be talking with different agents and you'll start to get a feel for people. And this applies to any consultant that you will have or be looking to involve on your team. You get a feel for them. You ask them the questions. You have a look at the projects that they've done or the work that they've done, and you can quickly begin to get a sense of who's right to work on your project.
And do you have a team, like in terms of a design team, planning team, legal, do you have an established team? Do you use the same team?
Yes, I think you keep using them until they don't perform, and then they get voted off the island.
And who's on your team now?
So a lot of the key people I've been using for 10 years. So the architect I've used for all my projects because they've done a great job. My legal people have been with me since the beginning. I'm still using the same sales agents. So the people that perform, they stay on the team, and you're always looking to refine your team until you've got that group of A-grade players.
Have you got a team of A-grade players?
Well, you're always refining. It's like any team. There's good people that are doing really well and exceeding, and then there's other people that you bring on that they may be good at the start, but then they start to fade, and then they let you down on something, and you find someone to fill that gap.
And what's your long-term goal? Like, what's your so we talked about establishing strategy and knowing your purpose and knowing whether you're building a brand or so. What is your long-term goal, objective, and how did you come to it?
So I'm very interested in doing projects with nice design that improve the fabric of the area in which we do projects. So how can we do things that make a change to the area that we're looking to do projects in, and which I find quite inspiring? And at some point, I'd like to do some pretty large scale land subdivision projects, which are probably going to take me a bit of time to get to. And that all comes back to sitting down and going through what your purpose is, why you're doing it, what inspires you, because you need that when you're doing development or any business endeavor, because you're going to face challenges. And when you hit those challenges and obstacles and hurdles, you want to understand why you're doing it, because that's what's going to help you push through that challenge and get to the other side and keep going.
And I guess how big a factor is persistence and just bloody-mindedness? Like how much of development is persistence?
Yeah, it's critical. It's absolutely critical. It's not just development. It's any pursuit. Anyone that's has their own business or works in corporate or works for somebody else will understand that there's challenges. It's just that's part of life. You're always going to have challenges. So no one's just going to say yes all the time. So you need to be quite resilient. I'd say it's probably the key trait of successful property developers. They're just really resilient and able to keep pushing ahead despite some of their setbacks.
Oh, look, and it can be, I guess I feel like I've just built up such a thick skin when it comes to dealing with council and planning lawyers, and you build up that layer of scar tissue almost, and nothing, you just go, yeah, all right, that's not good, but how do we just one problem at a time? It is almost like scar tissue. You do have to cop those blows and build up your, I don't know, what is it? Resilience, I guess.
Yeah, well, nothing worthwhile is usually easy. And so you do need to keep pushing ahead.
Yeah. And what are the things that you never compromise on in a development?
I think it's really important to understand and put down on paper what your standards and expectations are. And that can be for yourself, firstly, but then also for your business, and then stick by them. So figure out what are my standards and expectations on myself when I get into a hot situation. And that might be playing the person and playing the issue, not the person, for example, or believing in fair exchange. And if that's not happening, then as long as you're holding up your standards and expectations, then you can keep your head high when you get to the end of the road. So I think it's really, really important to understand that.
And can you share, delving in under the bonnet a little bit, can you share some of your standards or some of your personal, well, development, those things that you're talking about?
Yes. So I have one around fair exchange. So that's around being equitable when you're working on, for example, fee proposals. We're not looking to screw people down. We're looking to pay a fair price. Also, I have a standard around people delivering high-quality work.
Yeah.
And so we hold them to account for that. If they don't deliver high-quality work, we let them know.
And are you putting my cynical hat on, is that fair exchange? Are you really a property developer? Like, is that common, do you think? Like, being facetious, like
I don't know whether it's common, but that's a standard that I have. But that it goes both ways, right? I've got a fair exchange mentality, but that it's not a one-way street. It comes back the other way. And so if I feel like I'm not getting fair exchange from the other side, then I feel let down. And so am I going to use them again? Probably not.
I guess because the property developers are, well, maybe in Melbourne they're more subdued and polite, but in Sydney, I mean, they're ruthless. You know, some of them, even the well-known ones, absolutely. And I'm not going to name anyone at all, but they have a reputation for being brutal and ruthless. And these are the more successful ones.
But maybe that's their standards and their expectations, that you have to be brutal to succeed. I don't know them, but. I mean, another good one I have, I just mentioned before, is about playing the issue, not the person.
Yeah.
So always I just think, right, just got to play the issue, not focus on the personalities and get upset at this person, even though it's frustrating. It's like, let's deal with the issue. Let's try and put the personality aside and just deal with the problem.
I've learned that sometimes I've had underlying principles, I've had things that I really thought were a given. And over time, I've discovered that I actually had it back to front. Like, and I've had to really humble pie and go, okay, I got that wrong. I had that ass about, you know, to give you an example and to provide an insight. I think at some point I took I'm going to exceed market expectation and I didn't understand that there was a cap and there was a measure of sellable or cost per square meter. And in my mind, I thought the property would do better than it actually did until it was pointed out to me that I actually blew the market apart and I got a price per square meter that was for a waterfront property, even though it was on a quiet back street. And so I learned the hard way early. That was a while ago now, but I learned that actually I had a few things wrong. I'm wondering, what are the underlying principles that you may have had that you found were actually wrong, if any, or if you're happy to share, I guess.
Yes, one good one that I've been reminded of lately, because I've had some issues with my builder on a project that I'm doing, is that everything's okay until it's not okay. And so I remember spending quite a bit of money getting a contract drawn up and thinking at the time that's quite a lot of money to spend getting a contract drawn up when I haven't really had many issues with builders over the years. But then when things blew up with my builder and I had a really solid contract that I'd spent a lot of money on, I was relieved about it because, as I said, when everything's going okay, everything's okay and you don't think about it. But it's when something blows up that you then go, well, thankfully I've invested the time into a good consultant or a good contract, and you've got good people on your team that can help you when you need it.
Yeah. Can you share what happened? I'll put you on the spot. But
No, I've talked about it on my podcast. I just had a builder who was taking a long time getting a project finished and was demanding extra money that they weren't entitled to, and they ended up stopping working, and it was a pretty challenging scenario to be in. But I had a really good lawyer who drafted the contract, and so that gave me a lot of encouragement and power in the negotiations.
And is this a sort of post-COVID sort of struggle where I was talking to my former business partner who is a still very good friend, and he's a site manager and he does large, you know, sort of $5 million plus homes. And he said what used to be a 2-year project is now a 3-year project. That's the new normal. So because of supply, specifically labor shortage or pressure, is that kind of where you've been caught up?
Yes, it's a post-COVID hangover. And I understand that it's been difficult for builders and the building industry, but it's been difficult for everybody as well. Just as a developer, it's challenging also. And that's coming back. I mean, that might be an unexpected challenge that comes along while you're going through a project that you then have to deal with. But if for your listeners who are thinking of getting a project done, I think there's premiums for nicely completed product that people want, because the consumers understand that it's actually pretty challenging to get something delivered these days.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's the case. And there's a looming something. We don't know exactly what it is, but it feels like there's somewhat of an undersupply coming. And
it's here already.
Yeah.
There's a confluence of things happening in Australia at the moment that are quite unusual, in that you've got a surging population. So we're expecting, I think, 715,000 people over the next 2 years and something like 1.5 million over the next 5 years. There's already a rental shortage, and you've got housing approval numbers dropping.
Yeah.
So you've got number of population, people going up, number of dwellings being built going down, and a relative shortage of existing properties. So something has to give.
Yeah. And no one knows. Yeah. There's all these conflicting factors where it's interest rates rising, markets potentially, you know, slowing, and yet something and the underlying pressure of lack of supply. And so you kind of go, where is this going to end up?
And exorbitant build costs.
Exorbitant build costs and exorbitant build times, which are intertwined with the new, yeah. Like I said, the new normal is 30% blowout in time. And there's, like, you can see it all around. There's a building behind me that's been going for years, and it's not even a big job. And people just can't seem to get it. Well, I know it, because it's hard to get trades. It's hard to get skilled people. And so things are just dragging out. And people I feel like what's happening in some cases is people are trying to find, their budgets are blown. They're trying to find cost-effective solutions, and they're finding that the longer they wait, the more expensive things are getting, and that's trapping them. And I guess builders are in that, and a lot of builders have gone down, will continue to, you know, are ticking time bombs because they have liabilities that they can't meet. So
I remember a funny story with a colleague of mine who was getting a job priced up probably 12 or 18 months ago, and it was way higher than what he expected, and his designer said to him, oh, just wait a couple of months, the build prices might come down. And I said to him, they're not coming down. The sooner you can get it started, the better.
Yeah, and with a reputable builder who's priced it adequately, I guess.
And sure enough, the costs have kept going up and up.
Yeah.
Sadly, they don't often come down, Matt.
They never come down. I mean, I've been doing this for a very long time, and they settle. I guess costs of imports have gone down over time. So things that maybe were manufactured in Europe that then subsequently were manufactured in Asia have decreased in real terms. But yeah, labor rates never come down. That's the thing I know. Concrete prices never come down. Some commodity prices rise and fall if they've risen to, like steel is an example. But yeah, prices don't fall. So where does this, I guess, is it a good time to be a developer is the question. Is it a good time or is it a bad, is it a challenging time? If you've, you know, you've taken the leap some time ago to be a professional developer. Do you think if you were in the same position now, well, because you've started some years ago, right? Would you start now if you were in the same position?
I think there's always opportunity to do developments and do projects. And I think there will be for a long time to come, because Australia is a young, growing country. So there's always going to be growth. The challenge people face in a lot of metropolitan areas, and Sydney and Melbourne in particular, is just the cost of land has gone up so much. It's more than doubled over the last 10 years. So getting into projects is a lot more costly than what it once was.
How did you solve for that, or how did you start? Because you've gone into multi-residential, you're buying substantial blocks of land. How did you build that slowly, or did you bring investors in?
Yeah, you can bring people in to help share the cost and the risk. It's always a good measure. So if it's too expensive or too costly, or you're risk averse and you don't want to take on the whole risk, then sure, bring in some partners to share the load. And I think that'll happen more. There'll be just more people that are having to pool resources to do projects.
And did you bring investors in? Or how did you?
I've had investors on all my projects. I don't have the financial capacity, and nor do a lot of developers, to be doing multiple projects. You're always looking for investment money to leverage and get projects done.
And one of my, I guess, because one thing I found is that investors didn't really, I couldn't really attract investors. I almost gave up because two things. One is they love multi, they just have this idea of multi-residential being a multiplier effect. And so when you say my idea is to do one property at a time and it's a single residence, it's low risk because it's got an intrinsic value that we're not trying to turn it from something it isn't into something it is. I found it hard, even if I had the numbers, even if I showed the numbers, I found that it was hard to get people across the line. And the other thing I found was that investors, when you find opportunity and it's a demanding market, when it's a good market to buy, I should say, when it's a demanding market, when it's a quiet market, a lot of potential investors who expressed interest in investing were like, yeah, maybe. The minute the market hotted up, they're ringing me. And I'm like, well, it's a hot market now. It's a lot harder. I pitched these opportunities to you in a quiet market because it was a lot easier to find a good deal in a quiet market. I mean, do you find that? Is that something particular to, I guess, my product and the way I'm thinking?
I think there's always a bit of a chicken and egg conversation that goes on when you're trying to do projects. Do you find the project and then the investors, or do you find the investors and then go looking for the projects? And yeah, when the market's hot, everyone thinks that it's easy just to get in and there's quick money to be made. But often that can be a difficult time to get in.
So how did you get your first investors? How did you break through? Say someone's looking to buy something, but they can't do it by themselves. How do you get your first investor on board?
Well, you could sign up and do my training course for one. There's a yes. whole module around raising capital in the property developer training.
I love it.
I think you need to demonstrate that you know what you're doing and that the project that you're proposing to do is actually profitable and worthwhile. And if that's the case, then you should be able to find somebody who's prepared to invest. Because the question you should be asking yourself is, if I can't find an investor, why is that? Is it because the fundamentals of the project are not sound enough for me to be able to convince someone to invest the money? And if that's the case, then should you actually be doing it? Because if the fundamentals are there, you should have a story to tell around a good investment opportunity.
And how much of it do you think is fundamentals and underlying numbers, and how much of it is being able to get a deal done?
Well, it always comes back to the numbers. That's what investors are going to be looking at. And you can wrap a good story around that in terms of who you are and your skills and the location and all the research that you've done. But if it's a lousy return or not a great return for the project that you're doing, then why would someone invest in it? Why should you do it?
Yeah, I get it. I mean, I'm going to do your class, the property developer training, and yeah. Can you tell us like what it costs and how you run it?
Yeah, so it's the reason I came up with the training was because I got so many emails from the listeners of my show saying that they wanted to get into property development and they didn't know where to start. So I put together the program as a first point of call for them to learn step by step the process of a property development. And so it takes you from the very beginning, how the whole process works, how you put a team together, how you start looking for a site, how you do a financial feasibility, which is a key part of everything, the finances that are related to property development, finding the site, doing the due diligence, buying it, going through planning, getting your permit, finding a builder, doing the build, selling off the plan if you need to, or settling at the end and getting the money and celebrating.
And what's the format of that? Is it like in person or is it online?
So it's online. It's short modules that people can do in their spare time. Most of them are about 10 minutes long. You can just do the modules when you have time, on the train, on the way to work, whatever it might be, or at night when the kids are gone to bed. You can knock off a couple of modules and it's really easy to consume. There's lots of checklists for people to keep, to ensure that they're getting things done that they need to, for example, with due diligence. And then I've added extra content over the years in response to what people want. So there's a whole course in there around taking it to the next level, which is for people who might want to become full-time in property development. So thinking about the things that they need to consider if they're going to become full-time. And then not long ago, I published a new training course called Raising Capital, which is around raising money to do projects. Because as you just touched on, people are often asking about how they raise money to do their projects. So I did a whole course around how you go about doing that. Well, if you head to propertydevelopertraining.com, you'll be able to find everything there.
Great. And if we were to sum up three key takeaways from today's episode, I think the first one, I think I already know. I think it's know your purpose, know why you're developing, know why you're doing what you're doing, whether it's a one-off development or whether it's building a brand or trying to get into professional development. I guess the second one, here's my prediction. I am just another language model, so I'm just predicting a few things, and I might be wrong, but it's find a team and build a team is vital. So, Justin, you tell me if I've got any of those right and what I've missed.
Yep, I'd agree with you. The other one I would say is understand who you're creating or doing the development for, who's going to buy your end product, and understand them as much as you can.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think those three things, it doesn't matter whether you're Mervac or whether you're buying your first home. If you are doing it because you want to make a profit, then those three things are pretty universal, I reckon. Like I think that sort of nails it, really, in a way. If you do nothing else, then know why you're doing it and understand who's going to benefit from your development and build a great team to help you deliver. I mean, that's...
There you go. It's easy. Property development's easy.
It's that easy. And the other thing I'll add is listen to your team. Listen to your team. And I'll tell you a little story. I had my dad was helping me. My dad is ironically, I'm a licensed builder by trade. I'm a project manager and a builder. My dad is a software engineer who's retired. So I don't know what you make of that for a start. But I was helping my sister with her apartment renovation a long time ago. And my dad was a site manager. And he's like, I don't know what to do. I said, just go there and you're gonna open up and people will come and just you'll point to where they need to. Where the bathroom, you know, if there's a plumber, you point to the bathroom. And he's like, well, I don't know what to do. And I'm like, don't worry, just ring me when you, okay. And so he rings me and he's like, the plumber's got this. And he's some, and okay, here's what you do. Ask him what he proposes that you should do. And when he answers, just say, yeah, I approve that. Okay. He's like, yeah, I can do that. You know, he's gone in and it's like, yeah. And he's gone, yeah, I can do this. This is easy. And I'm like, okay, but it only works if you've got a good plumber. If you've got a terrible plumber, that will fail. So get a good team, but listen to them, I think, because I've seen a lot of people have a great team and not listen and have a misadventure, even with a great team. But,
well, and that's the role as a property developer is that you have to take on board the advice that you get given, but then ultimately make the decision about which way to go.
Yeah, but I think the answers are there, most of the answers. Occasionally, yeah, if with experience, you go, okay, I know what you're saying. I know what you're telling me, but we're actually going to do something a little bit different, and here's why. But, yeah, I think the best thing, that's the key to success, is listening to advice. And Justin, thank you so much. Thanks for all your advice and words of wisdom. Really appreciate you taking the time to come on our podcast.
No, it's been my pleasure, Matt. It's been great speaking with you.
You've been listening to Buildopedia. Please remember to like us and share our episode with your friends. We'd love your comments and suggestions. And we have a new website, buildopedia.au, where you can get in touch or leave a question and check out our blog.